As we all know from personal experience, August in Middle Tennessee can be hot. And the August of 1920 was particularly hot, especially in Nashville, where the eyes of the nation were focused like the spotlight shining on the stage of the Ryman Auditorium. Now, the reason that the nation was fixated on Tennessee that summer was that this state held the key as to whether or not women in the United States would be granted the right to vote. 70 years earlier, before that, in 1844, at a women's rights convention in Seneca Falls, New York, women had initiated the suffrage movement, seeking to allot one half of this nation's citizens a voice in its great democracy. The process of suffrage was slow, and it took generations of women petitioning, lobbying, and marching, with many of those being scorned, humiliated, beaten, and even imprisoned for their efforts. Finally, in 1919, Congress passed an amendment to the U.S. Constitution that gave women the right to vote. And the amendment was sent to the states for ratification. And at the time, there were 48 states. And so for this amendment to become law, 36 states needed to approve it. And so by August of 1920, 35 states had voted their approval. And of the remaining 13 states, 12 of them had either already rejected the amendment or it was certain that they would. So this left the future of the 19th Amendment to one state, the state of Tennessee. Now, the Tennessee Senate, they easily voted approval, and the prospects in the House looked promising as well. There was an initial poll of legislators, and that showed that 62 of them were in favor of the amendment and 34 against. It looked like it would pass. But in Nashville that summer, thousands of spectators, lobbyists, and reporters converged on the city. And all of these different interest groups began to exert pressure on the legislators. And the pressure was intense. And votes in favor of the amendment began to fall away. Now, at the time, this right to vote was known as suffrage. And those who favored women's suffrage were known as the suffs. And they distinguished themselves by wearing a yellow rose. We've got some beautiful yellow roses here with us today. And those opposed to women's suffrage were known as the antis, and they could be identified by their red rose. And this came to be known as the War of the Roses, a war that had been waged for over 70 years and whose final battleground would be Tennessee. The first vote to fall was that of Seth Walker, the Speaker of the House, and he changed his yellow rose to a red one. And then on the floor of the House, he gave a racially charged speech proclaiming, "This is a white man's country." And he warned that if women won the vote, then blacks in the South would demand it as well. Well, the truth is, black men had already been granted the right to vote with the 15th Amendment 50 years earlier. But the Jim Crow laws across the South prevented most of them from exercising that right. Those who opposed suffrage also included bootleggers. Prohibition was now in effect. And the good folks at Jack Daniel's, they set up a suite on the 8th floor of the Hermitage Hotel, where they plied the legislators with bourbon to induce them to change their vote. And they had some success with this. The 62 pledges for suffrage fell to 47, which was below the needed majority. On August the 18th, 1920, the day set for the vote, a motion was made in the House to table the amendment. And the result was a tie, 48 to 48. A second motion was made to table, and it also ended in a tie. So now, the vote on the amendment itself was brought to the floor with the understanding that a tie would mean the amendment would fail. It needed a majority to pass. The 19th Amendment was about to fizzle out in a tie. A roll call vote was begun, and the roll of legislators was called, and everyone voted as expected. But then they came to the name of Harry T. Byrne. Harry Byrne was 24 years old and the youngest member of the legislature. He was a Republican from Neota in East Tennessee, which is in McMinn County, halfway between Chattanooga and Knoxville. And twice he had voted to table the amendment. He wore a red rose. However, he had something that no other lawmaker possessed. He had a letter from his mother. His mother, Phoebe Byrne, everybody called her Feb, she had written her son a 9-page letter, which was mostly filled with updates on the farm and the family and the going on around town. Feb Byrne was a college-educated widow who managed the family farm, and she read 3 newspapers a day. And she and her son had talked about the importance of women's suffrage before he headed off to Nashville for the special session. She herself strongly desired the right to vote, and she pointed out rightly that the illiterate tenant farmers who worked for her, they could vote, but she couldn't. Harry, however, was up for re-election, and his constituency was clear. They opposed suffrage. In this letter that Feb wrote to her son, amongst all the family news and gossip, she did squeeze in just a very few lines about the upcoming vote that he faced, and she wrote this: "Hurrah and vote for suffrage, and don't keep them in doubt." When the vote came to Harry, instead of saying nay, as was expected, he very quickly said aye, and he pulled off his red rose. The vote continued, and the amendment passed 49 to 47. The Suffs had won, and women voted in that year's presidential election, all because of a young man's letter from his mother. In our scripture reading for today, we find a not dissimilar story about a young man and a request from his mother. This story is found in the Gospel according to John. This gospel begins with that famous prologue: "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God, and the Word became flesh and lived among us, and we have seen his glory." The gospel then introduces us to John the Baptist and Jesus of Nazareth and describes how Jesus called his 12 disciples. And all that takes place in chapter 1. Chapter 2 opens with this story about a wedding. The wedding is held in the village of Cana, which is up in Galilee, not far from the town of Nazareth. And the guest list includes Jesus' mother, Jesus himself, and his disciples. A wedding in that culture, it could last a week. It was an endless feast of food and drink. And at this particular wedding, Jesus' mother goes to her son and informs him, they have no wine. Now, we're not told why they've run out of wine. I mean, did more guests show up than was expected? Did the disciples neglect to RSVP? Were the guests drinking more than the budget anticipated? Had there been some issue with the order? We don't know. As you can imagine, to run out of wine at a great party like this would be catastrophically embarrassing for the family. It could be the faux pas that could define and haunt a marriage for years. Running out of wine was a tragedy in the making. And Jesus' mother is aware of this situation, and she alerts her son, telling him, they have no wine. And his response, it's a bit unsettling to us because he says, woman, what concern is that to you and to me? Now, first of all, just to get it straight, Jesus calling his mother woman like that sounds much harsher in English than it does in Jesus' language. We should probably translate it something like, dear woman, or even ma'am. Ma'am, what concern is that to you or to me? But that question is valid. I mean, what does it have to do with them? It's not their wedding. They're just guests. And then Jesus adds, my hour has not yet come. We're not exactly sure what this means, but it is clear that he does not feel that he should be doing anything at this time. His mother dismisses his hesitation and tells the servants, do whatever he tells you to do. It's as if she knows that he will do what is right. But what exactly does she expect him to do? Is she expecting him to perform some sort of miracle? I mean, this isn't a life or death situation. It's just a wedding. Or does she expect him, well, maybe to take those 12 unemployed friends of his and go down to the store and pick up a couple of cases and bring it back? They're not doing anything else. At this wedding, we're told that there are 6 large jars which hold water for ritual purification. As Jews, before eating a meal, a guest would go to a jar and ladle out just a small amount of water onto his or her hand. This was not intended to be a wash your hands with soap as you sing happy birthday scrubbing. It's just a ritual cleansing. And Jesus instructs the servants to refill these jars with water. And they do. And they draw water out of the well and they haul it back to the jars, filling them up to the brim till they can hold no more. Probably water splashing over the top. Jesus then instructs them to draw some of this water out of one of the jars and take it over to the chief steward. Chief steward was probably like the head caterer. The steward tastes the water that has been presented to him, but it's no longer just water. It has become wine. And the steward has no idea as to the origin of this wine, and so he calls the groom to come over and then commends him on his choice of such an excellent vintage. The steward tells the groom that in his experience, people serve the quality wine at the start of the party And then the cheap stuff when their guests are sufficiently inebriated and less finicky. You, he says, you save the good stuff for last. And then the story concludes by informing us that this act is the first of Jesus' signs. This action revealed his glory, and his disciples believed in him. His hour had arrived. Now, I have no intention of lifting up Harry Byrne as a Christ figure, because he's not. He was just a young man from East Tennessee, faithfully serving his district. But, as you can see, there are some intriguing similarities between these two stories, because in them we find two young men reluctant to take an action until urged on by their mothers. And in their actions, both of them herald in a new age. For Harry Byrne, it was assuring women the right to vote. For Jesus, it was his first sign of what he was to do. He would change the world. While Harry Byrne operated within the great halls of power of the Tennessee Capitol, Jesus worked in the back hall of a banquet room, and his actions were observed only by the servants. Harry Byrne wasn't Jesus, but his actions were Christ-like. His decision enabled the disenfranchised to have a voice. He brought justice into the world where there had not been any. And on Tuesday of this week, in just 2 days, we can celebrate this decision on the 100th anniversary of that Tennessee vote. As Christians, what we find in this story is what we find throughout the Gospels, a vision of a new reality. The wedding reminds us of how we make a new life together with God. Jesus is the new wine. And we may call turning water into wine a miracle, but the gospel calls it a sign. And that's what it is. It is a sign pointing to a new way of living, a new way of being with God in God's kingdom. In God's kingdom, life is abundant. Life is filled to the brim and running over. In God's kingdom, we enjoy the finest vintage of God's love. In God's kingdom, Jesus steps out and saves the wedding of a young couple without them even knowing about it. In God's kingdom, all are equal. All have a voice. Everyone enjoys a seat at the banquet table. Everyone drinks from the cup of God's grace. Everyone basks in God's glory. Everyone basks in Jesus' glory, because everyone is saved. Amen.